You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast Book Club. Adam Collins and Daniel Norcross are your hosts today. We're sat in a wine bar called the Cambridge in Soho, and appropriately we have a bottle of wine. And sat opposite us is ABC foreign correspondent, at least for two more days, teammate, friend, supporter of the show, former guest of the show in a completely different capacity, Steve Kinnane, who today is going to talk to us about his book from 2009, First Tests, Great Australian Cricketers and the Backyards That Made Them. Steve, wonderful to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back. I love listening to your podcasts. I love talking to you guys. I love being in Soho. I love being in London. So it's just a meeting of some beautiful places and people. I love it.
The reason we're doing it today is that I said nearly former foreign correspondent. Your tour of duty is officially up. You're returning to Sydney in a couple of days from when we're recording. And I think later in the podcast, we might talk a little bit about your experiences in Ukraine over the last 2 years. But
sure, where I used to listen to The Final Word at night time.
I love that. We did check once whether our, I think on the basis of your listenership, whether we might have spiked in the charts over in Ukraine. But anyway, but you know, there is a sense, as we're having some food delivered as well, give me that kind of podcast, that there's a sadness for you leaving the country because you've just loved being part of, even though you're proudly Australian, but part of sort of British culture, like playing cricket on a Saturday, that kind of thing's agreed with you.
Oh, I love London. It's one of my favourite cities in the world. I love it both for what it is and its history, but also as this incredible launching pad to travel around Europe. And I've been a correspondent around all of Europe, and to the stories that I've got to cover, a real privilege. And the cricket team that I found, courtesy of you, you sending an unsolicited email inviting me to play for the Authors Cricket Club, and me suddenly getting an email 5 minutes later saying, here's the itinerary, here's the next 40 games the Authors are playing. That has been one of the greatest cricket moments of my life, is playing cricket with the Authors Cricket Club, this unique bunch of funny writers. It's just such a great experience for me, particularly when I'm coming back for often covering quite traumatic stories, to kick about with these guys who are poets, journalists, sports writers, historians, novelists, children's authors, and just laugh a lot. It's been such a great experience.
And we presented you before with your pewter mug as the author's author of the year 2023. I mean, it's a nice thing to have that on the way out the door as well.
My wife, Catherine, describes the Authors as Brokeback Library. Because basically, she's never encountered a group of mostly English males, they're largely English males, who are so weirdly supportive of each other. Mm. Her experience of watching mostly English males play sport is that they remorselessly and continuously take the piss out of each other for the entire time. The authors, no. It doesn't matter how terrible a shot you played, one of them will supportively say, "You got a good one there, Dan. Oh, you were really unlucky." No, I wasn't. I played a terrible tip. No. I think it actually swung more than you're giving it credit for. They are unique in my experience.
But even though we're joking about supportiveness, I actually do think cricket is a beautiful game in that sense, in that you sit around while your team bats and you talk with your teammates and you get to know your teammates in a way I think you don't in other sports. And that makes... I've always thought that it is the most supportive sporting environment that you could ever hope for, because you really do get to know each other. And like, particularly in Australian cricket, where you play for 85 overs in an innings, there is not any question that has not been asked of your teammates. You really, really get to know each other quite well and take the piss out of each other. But I've also seen when your teammates can get into trouble, that your cricket mates look after you.
Hmm. Mm, it's a fair point. And I think, yeah, what you said before as well, Daniel, culturally over here, I think just generally in cricket, there's a good sense of that camaraderie. I mentioned you playing with the authors partly as a way into that. That's the eligibility for playing for them, is having written a book, right? Yeah. And you have done that on a couple of occasions, your Scientology book from 2016, which was an extraordinary piece of work. But this precedes it. This is 2009, so it's 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I remember reading it when I was living with you in 2017 in your spare room. And
when my house became a flop house for freelance cricket writers.
It was a lovely time. It was a great time when you were first
I had very good Wi-Fi.
I think the whole Chris Rogers book that Dan wrote with him was filed in that living room. But this first book, you did write it a long time ago, but it has so many parts to it. I reread it this weekend that are still relevant. But where I wanted to begin this part of the conversation was, how did you decide to write a book like this? It's such a bloody good idea. What's the origin story?
So it started out as a radio series, because I worked in radio a lot, and it started out playing in my local club cricket side, and one of my best mates, Rob Wynne-Jones, who is a very good player of fast bowling, he was batting in a cap with glasses on. He's got a double-barreled name and he's a very mouthy guy. And he's facing one of the fastest guys who played grey cricket in Sydney, who was bouncing him. And Rob was, at the last moment, playing this kind of half hook shot, half paddle, virtually off his eyes, around 45 degrees to fine leg, and it was infuriating this fast bowler. And I remember going out to, I think I had to take drinks out or something, and Rob was just loving it so much, and the other guy had steam coming out of his ears. And I said, I don't think I'd noticed it about his game before, but I said, how did you learn how to manufacture this shot? Because this is before the era of Dilshan ramps and using your wrists and all of that. It was quite a unique shot. And he just looks at me like I'm an idiot and goes, "Oh, it's simple. In my backyard, there's glass down the leg side, and I can't hit the glass. Otherwise, my parents are going to go berserk." So I learned how to, hook my mate who used to bounce me to 45 degrees. And that's what, and so then as we were sitting around, as we batted for the rest of the day, interrogated each other about our own backyard environments and how that led to us playing either certain shots a certain way or limiting what shots we could play. I came to the conclusion that I became a bowler because I had two sisters who weren't interested in cricket, no boys in the neighbourhood, so I used to bowl at a stump in the backyard. So all of us had facets of our game that were relevant to those formative years of us playing in the backyard.
And in the book, that comes through a lot. I mean, I don't want to skip straight to them yet, because one of the most wonderful aspects of the book is discovering the backyard that a certain person played on, like Neil Harvey playing on a sort of almost corrugated road, which is why he played the ball, but it's so well off the pitch.
Yeah.
So, which you can only ingrain from doing that over and over again. But first, before we get to the individual players, because there's so many wonderful stories in it, your backyard. Can you tell me about your backyard? What it looked like? How flat was it?
There was a slight slope, but it was pretty flat. And I used to bowl from one end, and there was a large brick wall, which was good because I could dig the ball in and it wouldn't go over the neighbour's fence. And there was kind of a stone garden built by my father, who was very handy in that way. and plenty of room to put stumps up, and I would just come off the short run, and I had wooden stumps, proper wooden stumps, nailed into the grass, and I would try and hit them. It was about, I feel like it was about 18 yards once the pitch. It was probably about 18 yards, so reasonably long enough to, you know, work out what you were doing. Yeah.
Interesting that, yeah, the deeper we get into the book, the more the size of the backyard becomes part of the narrative. There's some themes, there's some through lines. I mean, you cleverly break it up into sections based on the circumstances upon which these young boys and girls, I mean, it's not just men who are featured in the book, have grown up in. But the originals, as you describe it, the self-made men from Trumper to Bradman, so it spans those two players but includes Charlie McCartney, Arthur Maley, Clary Grimmett, fabulous chapter on Grimmett, which our listenership will enjoy you talking about, Bill O'Reilly, and then the Dom. I mean, a few things that jumped out at me. First of all, the extreme deprivation that some of these fellas grew up in, especially in Sydney. So thinking Trumper and Maley, especially Surry Hills and Waterloo and respectively. Yeah. I mean, it's to think of the way Australia and the way inner city Sydney looked like at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, it may as well be a different planet. I mean, we look at scorecards and think there's this through line from players that we look at the stats of now and how many runs and what's the average and how does it compare to 120 years ago or whatever. These guys weren't playing in anything like the circumstances upon which we see cricketers come through today.
That's right. Trumper and Maley grew up in slums and had siblings die of tuberculosis. They were dealing with extreme poverty. I wrote about, I think, the weirdness of Trumper and the grace of Trumper coming from the slums of Surry Hills, yet the grittiness of Alan Border comes from wealthy Mossman. It was this kind of weird inverse situation. But yeah, those two guys grew up in real poverty. So did those country guys like O'Reilly. You know, they were from big families. They had nothing offered them on a plate. O'Reilly, he was born in Whitecliffs, and his father had to put wet hessian sacks over the tin roof to make his wife a bit cooler after she gave birth to the tiger. And it's no wonder the tiger could bowl in any conditions. He was brought up in the roughest of conditions. So yeah, a lot of those guys really came from tough backgrounds, and it was a real theme, and it's a real theme in Australian cricket, is a lot of the best players come from the country or from state schools. They don't come from the best facilities. They come from areas where you have to struggle. And Daniel mentioned Harvey before. He grew up in Depression-era Fitzroy. I think he shared a room with his five other brothers, and they played on this back lane in Fitzroy on cobblestones. That was a time of real poverty then as well. So, yeah, a lot of these guys came from very modest backgrounds and, in some cases, extreme poverty.
With my English hat on, it's a kind of petrifying book in the sense that as you read it, you think, well, there's an inevitability to Australian grit, strength, determination. You know, when England go and play in Australia, there's always this terrible hunt for a gigantic man who can bang the ball in hard. And instead, we send the whippet-thin Jimmy Anderson, who's a terrific bowler, but he's like quintessentially English,
isn't he? But you've also sent John Snow, and you've also
sent... Oh, they happened.
But Frank Tyson.
But they tend to be from a different era as well, where deprivation was a bit more baked into the English game, where bowlers tended to be...
They were miners or sons of miners,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. Larwood is a classic example.
And that is where you sort of feel the affinity with English cricket in the backyard. You know, the story of Larwood, so brilliantly and absurdly brought to life in Bodyline, the TV series, of him running down a giddle and throwing a ball in a dustbin and a woman shouting, "Oi, Harold, stop that!" You know, completely the wrong accent. But there's that side of it. But there's also something that's like so daunting when you read it from an English perspective. You talked about Bill O'Reilly, you talked about his dad having a 1,000-kilometre round trip to do his exams to become a teacher.
I know.
And like, he's doing that on a bike.
Yeah.
With, like, no towns in between and getting his water from boreholes.
Yeah, yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, they are stories from a different era, we've got to admit as well, though. And, like, Australia is not like that anymore. Mm. But certainly those guys came from almost frontier-style lifestyles. It's quite incredible. But, yeah, Bill O'Reilly was tough. And you could tell that a lot of that came from his background.
And Bill O'Reilly hated batters. And
he hated batsmen. He hated coaches. He hated selectors. He thought captaincy was overrated. I think he once said that... what was it? he said a border collie with a blunt pencil could captain a cricket team. He said that coaches cause more grief than a sudden hailstorm. He very much believed in teaching yourself how to play cricket. And there's great stories about Bill O'Reilly. He's taught himself how to bowl a wrong'un by correspondence. His brother Jack O'Reilly was working for the Department of Agriculture in Sydney. Bill O'Reilly was living as a teenager in Winslow at the time, not far from where Bradman was living. And Jack O'Reilly went to the nets at North Sydney to see Arthur Maley, who just won the Ashes for Australia in 2021 with his leg spin, because he wanted to know how to bowl a wrong'un. And Bill O'Reilly's brother, Jack, just said, look, I stood behind him at the nets. I don't know exactly what I was doing, but it looked like it was coming out of the back of the hand and his wrist was a bit lower. So he writes that in a letter to Bill O'Reilly. I think O'Reilly was about 14 at the time. And so he takes that little nugget of information and teaches himself how to bowl a wrong'un. And he does it by bowling against a gatepost outside his house. And because it's not done with a coach, it has its own style. And so O'Reilly's wrong'un was known for climbing up the top of the bat, hitting the top of the bat, and Jack Fingleton, that other great Australian cricketer and writer, would be there on the leg side, close in, and get catches. So O'Reilly very much believed in these kind of homespun techniques, like Bradman's. And O'Reilly also had this fierceness of independence and fierceness of character, and he was 20 years old and he got invited to train for New South Wales. So, you know, his big moment. And this selector came up to him and said, if I was you, I'd change your grip on the ball. That selector was Arthur Maley. And Bill O'Reilly basically turned around at him in a fit of anger and said, well, if it's good enough to get me here, I think I'm going to stick with that grip, you know? Like, and he was exactly right. He was saying, why would I change? It's the thing that I've learned how to do. The same thing happened with Bradman and his grip. And Bradman stuck with his grip and it became almost the prototype of how we should bat, except we've never really learnt from that. So, yeah, those guys were very much self-made men. They had homespun techniques, often forged in the bush, and they worked for them.
And what was that line that Robertson Glasgow had about Bill O'Reilly and his personality?
I think he said something like he had a face that looked like it could either found or sack a city.
Love that O'Reilly. I love the O'Reilly-Maley intersection there. But this is like constant. These guys who have a relationship watching them or coming into contact with them or seeing them in the nets or whatever it is, and then go on to do the same thing they did. And I mean, so many of these chapters, you see these little nice intersections. Perhaps the most beautiful one is what you described there with O'Reilly and Maley, but it goes the whole way through. I mean, take, for example, Bradman, the first time that he went to the Sydney Cricket Ground, he was watching Charlie McCartney. McCartney inspired him to get to the SCG himself one day.
And Charlie McCartney was inspired by Victor Trumper.
Yeah.
And in fact, trained in a net that when Victor Trumper moved to Chatswood, set up his own net in his backyard, and Charlie McCartney ended up training on that. So there is this lineage from Trumper to McCartney to Bradman. And similarly with leg spin, I think there's a very good argument why Australia won the Ashes so many times in the 20th century is leg spin. That is, in many ways, the difference between Australia and England. And you've got these great leg spinners, Grimmett, O'Reilly, Benno, Warne, and they used to share secrets with each other as well. So Maley, in effect, teaches O'Reilly the wronger without knowing it through correspondence. But also Grimmett invents the flipper.
Yeah.
The flipper is taught to Richie Benno. Richie Benno passes it on, I think, to Jack Potter, who taught Shane Warne how to bowl it in a hotel corridor. So this kind of knowledge, and also even what balm to put on your fingers when your spinning fingers go raw. Or, you know, O'Reilly had a big influence on Benno, particularly, I think it was on the 53 tour, about how to bowl, So they pass these kind of secrets on to each other, and there's a real crossover. And even like Ray Linwall, one of the great Australian fast bowlers, he was inspired by Larwood. He went to the SCG and saw Larwood bowl and was inspired by him, and his action was like Larwood's, you know? So a lot of it was from watching and learning, and yeah, there's a real lineage.
But there seems to be also a slight difference between the urban and the country. And it's more pronounced in Australia than it would be in, say, England, because if you're in the countryside in England, even in the early part of the 20th century, you are an hour's bike ride tops to a small town where you can go and play cricket.
Yeah.
In Australia, you find a lot of these characters in your book live in very solitary environments, And so the repetition of what they do is sort of a factor of not exactly loneliness, but separation from outside. So you've described the sort of lineage of chat that happens.
Yeah.
But there's also a kind of fierce independence of discovery.
Yeah.
Because the more separated they are from the urban, the kind of the more it's just happening in their own space. And so they become kind of totally unreconstructed. And I guess that's kind of what gives Bill O'Reilly a little bit of his confidence to say, well, this is my method.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know, do you think it's possible for that to happen anymore? Are we now too interconnected? Are coaches just going to wipe that out of you? I mean, we still get people like Malinga. We still get his sort of recent copy, although it's a copy of Malinga, in fairness, isn't it? Paterana, I think. So there is still unorthodoxy out there, but has that kind of exotic unorthodoxy really gone for good?
I think it's been definitely diluted. There is far more uniformity when it comes to techniques. And also there is so much coaching and there is so much play in nets as well. You know, so there's not as many scratch games as there used to be. There's not people playing in parks or in streets. I'm talking mostly from my view from Australia. And also in those kinds of games, you learn certain things, like you learn how to manufacture shots because there's gaps in certain parts of the, you know, or the... but in the nets, you learn often, you know, even with a bowling machine, you know, it's like it's a uniformity of how to hit a cover drive and how to do this and do that. Obviously, we're seeing more inventiveness in the forms of reverse sweeps and ramps and all of that. But I do think there is far more uniformity, and I don't think you can have an O'Reilly inventing a way to bowl a wrong in the way that he did with that isolation. And I also just think you don't have kids just religiously practicing cricket as often as those guys did.
Well, the dedicated practice bit that you were... Yeah, I think the preamble of the book goes to... probably would have been that Gladwell's Outliers was released around the same time that you're... I'm thinking about...
It was about a year or two before.
Right, so the 10,000 hours and so on. But, yeah, dedicated practice. And I know that theory isn't without contest. But just the idea that not having so many things to bloody distract you. I mean, when cricket became an obsession to the point of no other, or the exception of all else. I mean, and this is a part of the Martin Chapel story that we might come to in a little bit, but you need to dedicate yourself wholly. But you know, the second group of players here mentioned depression era, right? Yeah. So this is your Sid Barnes, Keith Miller, Ray Lindwall, Betty Wilson, Neil Harvey. I mean, goodness gracious, I mean, what five extraordinary names they are, just to rattle off in sequence, having one thing in common. But having the flexibility in this book to talk about a total ideas man like Sid Barnes, who was just as happy, well, more happy probably, making a quid on tour than he was making a run, but finishes with one of the great records in Test cricket.
Oh, yeah, and Arthur Morris... just a lovely man and one of the best opening batsmen Australia's ever produced told me what it was like to room with Sid Barnes. You know, like you would suddenly see a whole lot of cloth that he'd bought somewhere that he was then going to take back to Australia and sell at a very escalated price. But Barnes was an extraordinary batsman. Like, he averaged, I think, in the 60s, didn't he, in the end?
Yep.
Should have played way more tests, but also had a larrikin streak which upset certain establishment figures. Yeah, but he used to collect the rents for his mother around the inner city of Sydney, and also he used to provide the equipment for his street games, which would mean that if he was not happy with, you know, the umpiring decisions, he might take his bat and ball and go home. But Sid also had a big scar over his lip where he'd been shanghaied because there was a dispute over an umpiring decision in a street game, and they were quite tough street games played in the drains near Stanmore. So yeah, all of those guys played a lot, like Harvey's played in the streets, Ray Lindwall played in the street, and Bill O'Reilly lived near Ray Lindwall in Hurstville, where Ray Lindwall played in the street. And Bill O'Reilly was a school teacher, and he would finish school and walk down the street, and all the kids are seeing one of the great test cricketers of the day walking down the street, and so Lindwall's running into bowl and trying to impress O'Reilly as a teenager, and he in fact plays with O'Reilly in the end for the St. George Club. So yeah, there are all these connections between these guys.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Ian Chappell. You're listening to The Final Word.
I'm doing what we usually do on The Final Word and skipping over the main story. And Bradman, we do this all the time. And let's put Don to one side, because we actually know what Bradman's background is, right? Yeah. And we're skipping in and out here. One other theme from the early part of the book, and it comes through really strongly with a number of the guys, is their ability and willingness to practice before breakfast. I mean, so many of your chapters involve pieces about netting at 5 in the morning, about pickup games at 6 in the morning, all before they actually started their actual day, which would be unheard of right now. Yeah. And as you talk to that, a man who was perhaps more obsessively dedicated to practice than anyone that's played the game, Clary Grimmett, and his willingness to do whatever it took to improve as a bowler into his 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, he never retired, did he, Clary Grimmett? He's the epitome of a cricketer who would have done anything for success, and a lot of it started at a ridiculous hour of the morning, every morning.
Yeah, and to go back to the first chapter, Victor Trumper, his father used to take him out of Surrey Hills up to Moore Park and throw balls at him for 2 hours every morning. And that's why, one of the reasons he was so good. Yep. Charlie McCartney did the same thing at Chatswood Oval. They had him and his brother used to go up and use the first grade pitch very early in the morning before any council workers. In fact, the police got called one time to kick the McCartney boys off the Gordon first grade pitch. And so Bill O'Reilly used to do it as well. He used to have net sessions with his club, tell them to get down the park at 6 in the morning. Yeah, so these guys were extraordinarily dedicated, and they would find however many hours in the day that you could. And getting back to even the Chappell brothers, you know, in that era of guys, they would get home from school, throw their bags in the corner, and just get out at 3:15 and then play till nighttime. So it's hour upon hour that they're playing. But yeah, there was a dedication to what these guys were doing, and it's no wonder that they got really good at what they were doing.
The Grimmett chapter, I think it'll be required reading for most people who've listened to the show, and I don't know if you picked up on this, Daniel, but we're looking at the options to try and buy his childhood house at the moment. I mean, it's a bit of an out there idea, but Jeff and Brat think it might be possibly being worked up for sale in New Zealand, and we're like, well, maybe we throw the hat around. Anyway, I digress. You had a lot of fun writing that, clearly.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of my favourite things about that is it was Clary Grimmett. His backyard pitch was in his 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, as you point, up to his 70s. He was working on a ball at the age of 73, which was the wrong one, apparently, and it only went about 10 metres, but he was still trying to get
what's
it to go
the point in the wrong one? I mean, they just bowled the stock ball.
But he also invented the flipper, one of the great balls in his backyard. I think his backyard at Caulfield, when he was playing in Victoria before he moved to South Australia. And one of the things about the flipper when he invented it was it came with a click. And so batsmen then started to go, oh, yeah, here's Clary's flipper. We're hearing the click. But then Clary, whose nickname was the Fox, outfoxed the batsman by occasionally, when he'd deliver his leg spinner, clicking with his left fingers as he was bowling. So the master of the dark arts, Clary Grimmett, would outfox the batsman. And he had this fox terrier called Joe who would retrieve the balls, once again maximising the amount of deliveries that he could bowl. And he would bowl in his backyard net 365 days a year. There was no cricket season for Clary Grimmett. Every day was cricket season. And he was perfecting all kinds of different balls. He should have played. He was averaging 6 wickets a test match. 1 wicket more a test match than Shane Warne. And he should have played far more test matches. He should have been picked earlier. And he should have continued to be picked. He should have been on a 1938 tour. And O'Reilly was outraged. It gave O'Reilly another reason to hate Don Bradman, that Grimmett did not play on that trip. And there's a great story too, I think, where Clary Grimmett was talking to Neville Curtis about World War II. Was, you know, and Neville was saying, what an awful thing, you know, World War II.
It's a beautiful part of the book.
Because
when he goes really lachrymose, he says, oh, Clary, the war has taken so many things from us. It's taken young men and hope and buildings and the architecture. And then what does Clary say?
Clary says, yeah, and I haven't been able to play first-class cricket. You know, I've got some new balls I want to try out on some batsmen.
And he's 54 at the time.
So good, so good.
I've talked about the vastness that comes into this book, and I don't know, were you really conscious of it when you were writing? From an English eye reading the book, it feels really Australian, and I mean that in a really good way. I felt like I was transported into the different eras of Australia because of the massive difference. You know, the backyards that you talk about, can be as impoverished as a street. But even the middle classes, you know, the Chapels are living in this house where they walk in through one door to come out to bat. And then when they get out, they walk out, back into the kitchen, through the utility room, back out again,
right,
pretending to be somebody
like
else.
Like it's a pavilion. Yeah, yeah. You're going in and out.
And so this kind of, this felt like it was ingrained in the book and ingrained in Australian culture in a way that just doesn't ring true of anything in England at the time, you know, or any time, really.
Right, right.
And I don't know, what do you sort of ascribe that to? Because it feels quintessentially Australian to me.
So it's interesting that you describe it in that way, because I wasn't thinking of it necessarily in that way when I was writing it. All I was doing was making sure that I told the stories in a way that reflected the time and place of those stories. So when I wrote about Trump as Surry Hills, I went through the history books and was able to describe it in a way of what it was. So I really wanted to set a sense of time and place. And so that probably comes across naturally as very Australian. But I also make the point that this is where Australia, to me, got its comparative advantage of, you know, blue skies, good weather, long summer days, where you had that time to practice, and also open space. Just having space where you could play, and even the guys who were stuck in cramped inner city areas, they found ways as well. And so I think there was always an inventiveness with those kids when they were growing up of finding a way of playing the game that they loved and getting better at it. So I'm not surprised that it feels that way to you, because I was trying to describe it, so it probably comes across in a way that does seem foreign because it's a different country and people write about it that way.
Well, also, I mean, it feels both simultaneously when you read it, it feels both simultaneously small and vast. That the kind of ecosystem is smaller because there are so many fewer people, but they're distributed over a much wider area. Mm. Now, you kind of get thinking to yourself, and I don't know whether this is just an English brain thinking that there's nothing to do, but it almost feels like these people have invented a lot of these games because there was almost nothing else to do. There's a great chapter, the Healy chapter, when you discover that they did the same sort of thing as the Chapel brothers, namely recreate a test match. And the oldest brother's always Australia.
Yeah.
And poor old Ian Healy was always England, like Greg Chapel was England and Ian was Australia.
But does that not happen in England?
Not really.
Right.
Not the same way.
So that was massive, all the guys I spoke to.
But they play the whole test match. But what a great detail in there. And this is where they're in their fantasy world. You can feel the child in them. Is that if John Edrich, if you were coming out to bat as John Edrich, you bloody well had to bat left-handed.
Right, right.
I'm not a left-hander. No, I don't care. You're John Edrich.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, like the immersion in the game is wonderful.
Yeah, and you are playing it like a proper test match. And so, Greg Chapel scored 100 on debut in Perth in 70-71, and he just said, well, it was nothing compared to playing against Ian in the backyard.
Yeah. I mean, it does sound brutal. I mean, you go to that Chapel chapter, which is such an evocative one with the level of detail that they've provided. I mean, it's brutal, right? Like, they're wet and by design. Yeah. I think this is crucial. This is a slightly different era. We're talking about, we're jumping all over the place, and that's fine. This is the post-war big backyards, that classic quintessential Australian quarter-acre block in the suburbs thing, right? Where there is sufficient room, in the case of the Chapels, to actually have a turf pitch installed.
A proper turf pitch because with the same soil, I think, of the Adelaide Oval.
Right, because Martin missed out on the opportunities due to World War II to play first-class cricket. He wasn't going to leave any stone unturned when it came to his sons.
Yeah.
And they realised that to make it to the next level, they had to dedicate themselves wholly. And that included not wearing protective equipment, and it included giving no inch, and Ian getting up in Greg's face, hitting him constantly. Yeah. And that was just normal life for these brothers who all went on to play for Australia, and in the case of Ian and Greg, captained their country.
And so bear in mind that the Chapel brothers, their grandfather was Vic Richardson, who captained Australia and was, you know, considered a great captain, and also one of the great all-round sportsmen that South Australia has ever produced in a myriad of sports. So on the mum's side, they had that. But on the father's side, Martin, I think, played grade cricket for over 20 years in Adelaide. Very competitive man. And these three guys, the Chapel brothers growing up, they also loved playing. But it was a brutal environment. They were playing with a hard ball from a young age. And Greg told me the story about Ian hitting him with the hard ball. I think he jammed the thumb or the finger up against the handle of the bat, and Greg hit the deck and was in tears. And Ian's like 4 or 5 years older than him, so there's a massive age gap. And he said that he sees Ian coming up to him and thinks, oh my God, for the first time, I'm going to get some sympathy from my older brother. And Ian says to him, mate, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you. The next one's at your fucking head. So it was a brutal environment, and they played them as test matches, as you mentioned, Daniel, but where they bat 1 to 11, and when you get out, you go in through the pavilion and you come out, I think it was the laundry, come back out, and you come out as the next batsman. And, you know, poor Greg, not only did he have Ian terrorising him, but he had to be England. I mean, fancy that. Imagine. So it was a very tough environment. But also they learnt, these guys learnt really important lessons in cricket. Like, you learn how to survive. Like, in a tough situation, you learn how to guts it out. And you'll also learn how, and in Greg's case, he learned how to survive against Ian and dominate against Trevor. And so, what a poor Trevor. Trevor once went after Greg where he didn't like an umpiring decision with a tomahawk, and Greg had to run, jump over the fence and run down a few blocks before he was willing to turn around to see, is Trevor still chasing me with the tomahawk or not? So it was a blood sport. And it shows you how hard those guys, they play cricket so hard, those guys. And it came from their backyard.
And there's even that theory within that because Trevor didn't get to play grade cricket at school in the same way that the school submitted a grade team when Ian and Greg were at school, they identify that as a link because playing against men, and this comes through strongly as well, all these young boys who got to play against men at formative stages, the Doug Walters chapter leans right into that. Love the detail with Walters, and maybe I would say this being a radio broadcaster, saying that when he walked out to bat on Test debut, famous century on Test debut, Walters, he's like, well, actually, I've never seen these guys bowl before, but I felt like I had through Alan McGilvray. Yeah. Alan McGilvray's detail provided me with a line of defence. I kind of knew what was coming.
I think he referenced in particular Fred Titmuss. He said that he knew how Titmuss bowled through the way Alan McGilvray had described that on the radio. That is extraordinary. He'd never seen him bowl, and he scores 100 on debut against them. And that was a very evocative theme too, as a lot of those guys of that generation had grown up listening to the radio. Alan Davidson told me that about, you know, he was in an area in New South Wales in the Gosford region where it was hard to get radio reception, and the things they would do to get the aerial in the right place so he could listen to the test matches at night in England. So yeah, the radio had a big influence on those guys as well. And Dougie Walters' backyard pitch was sensational. It was made out of rolled ant beds on a dairy farm in Dungog, and it was like a real turning pitch. And he was an amazing player of spin bowling. And I remember talking to him about this and how good he was playing spin. And he said that, one of the things that Dougie did that no one else could do is he played in 73, I think it was Port of Spain. West Indies picked about four spinners, including the great Lance Gibbs, and cooked up a turning pitch. No one in that match scored over 30 except Doug Walters, who scored 100 in a session. And no matter where they put the fielders, Doug found a gap. So, and he does admit that a lot of that ability to play spin bowling comes from that pitch that he grew up playing on in a dairy farm with his siblings and his parents, because they were in on the test matches as well.
What I've sort of felt in the last five, 10 minutes of this conversation is something that has crystallised for me, something that I've always known, really. When you talk about Alan McGilvray and the Aussies actually listening into Alan McGilvray to find stuff out. Like, in England, that was never the case. You did not tune into radio commentary to find out what was going on. You tuned into radio commentary to hear about a fantasy world that we call cricket, which is a complete la-la land. What you're sort of describing in the whole book is the sort of gritty, aggressive, like, the whole sort of DNA of Australian cricket. And when you look at sort of the DNA of English cricket, completely different. It's completely different. Do you know what I mean? I mean, all these stories are about aggression, about being forged in the wheel of fierce competition, about the game being really serious and about how it really matters. English cricket has always really tried to downplay the importance of the game. It is essentially silly. It is essentially frivolous.
And social,
exactly.
But whereas in Australia it is like playing for sheep stations.
You're trying to kill your brother.
You are trying to survive and trying to kill your brother. And those kind of stories really came out with people I spoke to. I mean, occasionally, like the Hussey brothers, for example, Dave used to end up in the car and, you know, sometimes crying and have to lock himself in the car because of what was going on. So, yeah, they were, and the Chappell brothers very much so. When I spoke to the Lee brothers, Brett Lee and Shane Lee, I mean, I went down to their old house and you can still see the dings in the garage door where Shane would suddenly get into a bit of throat music with the hardball when the parents were out. You could see the dents in the garage door. It was quite extraordinary.
This is Jeremy Coney, and I'm on The Final Word.
Just going back to the, I mean, what you describe here is that the radio age, section three of the book, Richie Beno. Now, it feels like we know so much about the Beno story, but the detail you're able to bring to light, having talked to the great man. I mean, remember, this is 4 or 5 years before he passed away.
Yeah.
And how generous he was with you, not only in compiling the information, well, you can pick up the story, but, I mean, literally sub-editing a chapter on him.
Well, Richie, a lot of people don't realise that Richie was a trained journalist and he was a police rounds reporter in a Sydney tabloid while the captain of the Australian cricket team. Imagine that. Richie, while playing cricket for Australia, his day job is probably talking to corrupt cops, probably phoning in stories from a phone booth about some accident that happened on Oxford Street. And that is his day job. In fact, I worked with a tabloid, legendary tabloid journalist in Sydney called Frank Crook, who was the other police rounds reporter while Richie was on one paper. One was on the Mirror, one was on the Sun. And Frank turned up at car crashes and Richie would be there and all the cops would just be making a beeline to Richie to give him all the information and poor Frank got nothing. But he said Richie generously would wander over to him and go, okay, Frank, there was three fatalities, you know, like, you know, so he would then pass on the information because he was a generous guy. So I sent the chapter that I wrote about Richie to him because I always tried to send the chapters to them because I didn't want to make mistakes about something so sacred to them, their childhood games and how they played. And I just wanted to get them right. So I'd send a chapter to Dougie and he'd go, yeah, that looks good. But with Richie, of course, not only did he went through it and he then added words. He said, you should maybe describe the tram that I caught to the first test match in this way, or you could, you know, describe the radio that we listened to in this way. And I think I talked about a choco vine and how he had to eat chocos. And I think I described chocos as foul tasting. And Richie went, no, that they were tasteless. So he wanted to make my chapter better, which was beautiful. So I sent Colo the email before today. I dug it out and I sent the email because it's a thing of beauty where Richie wants the chapter to be accurate and better. And so he subbed it for me. It was fantastic.
What an amazing thing to just have in your inbox there. You're able to dig out the email that Richie Beno sent me to make my book better. It's precious, absolutely precious. As I'm mindful that we could go through every single cricketer you've written about here, and we won't do that because we'll be here all night. But just a working theory about the size for the gardens the backyards that you refer to for some of the guys later on. Let's use Adam Gilchrist for instance. I mean, Adam Gilchrist goes on to have this extraordinary career that we all know back to front. But it starts in the backyard as well, and it's in no small part due to his dad realising that it's actually the space to build a cricket net. So we're not talking about, you know, the Trump era or the McCartney era or the Arthur Maley era when it's like trying to find some street to play some pickup game or going to a net at 5 o'clock in the morning or grade practice or bowling to the post that O'Reilly was or many other stories you've referred to this afternoon. For that generation, it's like, right, how do we take our backyard to the next level to make sure we've got a comparative advantage on the other kids in the street?
Yeah, so Stan Gilchrist, Adam's dad, was a school teacher and a really good cricketer and a cricket coach. He played New South Wales second 11. I think he played for Australian universities as well. And he was a leg spinner. And once again, Richie Beno gets into this story. But just to describe the Gilchrist backyard, it was like a cricket academy. It was an astroturf pitch, proper netting. And so he didn't have the restrictions of what shots he could play because of glass, because he had nets. So he could hit the ball anywhere. And that's something that people talked about with Gilchrist's game, that he didn't have a weak spot. He could hit the ball to any point in the ground. They had video technology, so you could film and look at how his technique. He also had these systems of different weights and pulleys to strengthen Adam's arms, which You know, like, does he still hold the record for the most sixes in? No, he didn't. But he got 100. He's got over 100 sixes in Test cricket,
only
right?
Overtaken by McCullum and Stokes.
By McCullum and Stokes, right? And so he
where
had
the game
that
is radically different, of course. But, you know.
But he had that power, right, in his arms. He had that ability to hit sixes. But Stan learnt from Richie in the training in New South Wales. Richie used to say, "Let's practice the thing you're best at the end of the session." And for Stan and Richie, that was your leg spin. So Stan identified really early on that Adam's best thing was just hitting the ball, almost just not thinking about it, right? Just smashing the ball. And so at the end of each session he'd have with Adam, he'd just say, "Okay, just hit the ball. Just hit the ball." And I think that freed Adam's mind in the way that he batted, in that if he came in to bat at 5 for 50 or 5 for 350, he just hit the ball, and that became his thing. He watched the ball and he hit it. And I really think that that comes from Richie talking to Stan, teaching him how to practice, and Stan, you know, liberating Adam and seeing what he was good at and encouraging him to play to that strength. And by the way, talking to Stan, Stan was just the most lovely man, as was Ted Hussey, Mike Hussey's father. And I think that really reflects on those guys too, that they had really... really gentlemanly fathers, and you can see that in the spirit of who they became.
Yeah. That's spot on, isn't it? Yeah. You look at it's not just the cricketers they are, but the men they are, right? In the case of Gilchrist and the Hussies.
Yeah.
And you know, the beauty of this book is that it's conceivable you could do another version of it, right? I mean, you could go and talk to a whole bunch of cricketers.
I could do an international version and talk to, I'm sure, well, Sangakkara has a story like this, right?
Yeah. And I mean, so does Glenn Maxwell. I mean, we've spoken to Glenn's parents last year on the program about they made a trail between the house and the club that he played for, South Belgrave, cut out a special gate in the fencing so that he'd have a beeline from the front yard to the nets at South Belgrave across the road, but the backyard slanted in a certain way. He's one of many players, right, who would have their own story, but... I guess the one small thing that I'm interested in, and Daniel touched on it before, is that as cricket and as life has evolved, I just wonder whether the stories are going to be more homogenised. I wonder whether the stories might be a little bit more, and not to discredit the Gilchrist story, it's an absolute belter, but whether they might be a lot more Adam Gilchrist than they are guys who, you know, grew up with that kind of classic on-the-farm existence, even with the world being as it is today.
I think so, far more homogenised, and also... far less time spent playing scratch games where you actually learn how to win, and so therefore more time spent perfecting a cover drive rather than learning how to win.
You hear this all the time from coaches, especially English coaches of a certain who are coaching people of the modern era. So anybody who's basically sort of under 25, and you'll hear the same lament over and over again, that the players they have, they know how to play a beautiful shot. They know how to play against the bowling machine. But when things get horrible out there, then all hell breaks loose. And you know, in a strange kind of way, I credit what Ben Stokes is doing with England's team as a sort of necessary corrective to this, which is recognises that there's no way you can instill those levels of competitivity, the rage, the determination, the desire actually to raise yourself from terrible deprivation. Because the England cricket team is filled with people who went to public school. We know this. It's well documented.
Yeah.
There is not public school in England means wealthy people's schools. You have to pay to get in. It's because it's England. Of course, we use language completely wrongly. In fairness, we did invent Newspeak. Thank you, George Orwell. So there is a reason for that. But yes, public schools are where either wealthy people go or people get scholarships. So Harry Brooks, not from a wealthy family, but he got a scholarship to go to one of these great schools.
And so they play on really good turf pitches, don't they?
They play on really good turf pitches. And so Ben Stokes has got to make the game really good fun.
Yeah.
So we're going to go out to India and, you know, you could complain about the food if you wanted to 10, 15 years ago. We're not going to do that. We're going to play golf. We're going to have a really good time. It's going to be great fun.
Right.
Not it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to be a bastard to win it.
Right.
And that's like such a magnificent change of thought, isn't it?
Yeah. But bear in mind, I wrote this book in 2009. And so I was already talking about how things had changed, how backyards had shrunk, how families weren't as big anymore. So you didn't have...
Yeah.
three older brothers.
That's the year of the iPhone being released, right?
Yeah.
2009.
Yeah, exactly.
Often that's identified as a massive turning point in the way that young people, and not just young people, but especially young people, how their brain, their neural pathways are wired.
And how much time they spend in their bedrooms compared to being outdoors. So already you could see that things were changing. And I actually, in the intro to the book, kind of said, maybe Australia's, well, at the time, you know, they were still winning a lot of test matches, but I said maybe if you look at how things are changing, that their comparative advantage is diluting and they may not dominate as they were dominating at that time. And I do think it has, I think there's lots of factors in all of these things, there's cyclical things, but Australia doesn't have as much of a comparative advantage, I don't think, as they did when I was writing about that generation of Warne and Gilchrist and McGrath and those guys.
It's such a good book. I mean, I loved rereading it. It's a really special book, I think. I really recommend that everybody read it. Just wanted to, I think a lot of our listeners will be fascinated in what you've been doing in the as the European correspondent for the ABC for the last few years, your second stint as a foreign coro over here, because so much of it's been influenced by the Ukraine war. I mean, you were in Ukraine within weeks of the war starting in February 2022, and you've been there multiple times since. I mean, now having been a war correspondent in addition to having been a foreign correspondent, just try and give our listeners a sense of what that life's been like for you over here, but more over there, really.
Well, it's been some of the most rewarding work I've ever done, to go and see the people in a country, a sovereign country that's been invaded by a neighbour, and how they refused to buckle to that. I mean, the predictions were that the country was going to collapse within a week and the Russia was going to take Kyiv, you know, the second strongest army in the world. We're now over 2 years in and that country has continued to resist that and in fact took ground back. I mean, they're really struggling at the moment. They're really struggling due to a lack of ammunition. I mean, people I've spoken to say the Russians are firing somewhere between 5 to 10 times as much artillery on the front lines, and that's making it incredibly difficult for the Ukrainians to hold it. But look, I've always been inspired by countries where democracy is highly valued. I remember watching in 1999 the East Timorese queue up and vote for independence and similarly when the first time when all South Africans could vote in elections, that they are historic moments. And so when people value that democracy so much and fight for it, it is quite inspiring. And that's what the Ukrainian people at the moment are doing. It's an existential crisis for them. They're fighting for their existence as a nation. And I have interviewed people on the front lines. Last time I went there, I interviewed a father and daughter. The daughter was a drone pilot. The father was driving a truck to the front line back and forth every day. And there was a father and son in that battalion as well. And they're doing everything to defend their country's sovereignty. So to go and to talk to people like that, to me, is a real privilege. And I wish I could have gone back more often. That's not always in my control. I have bosses who tell me where to go and do. I've always tried to go in there as often as I can. And, the people there... It's an amazing country, and I'd never been there before. I went there for the first time, I think, 3 weeks before the war began. So that was my first taste of Ukraine, and it's a very special country, and the people are quite extraordinary, and it doesn't look like it's going to end soon. And it's a really, really important war for people to focus on, because it's about the future security of not only Europe, but the world. It's about the security of sovereign nations' right to exist and not to be invaded and not to have certain powers want to redraw the borders, like what was happening, you know. And Daniel, I know that you know the history of Europe and the 20th century of European wars so well, but like some people talk about this being a 1939 moment, and it is a really important moment in history, and to go there and to talk to those people and to see them fight for their country, I've been very, very fortunate to do that.
It feels like a 1939 moment, but it also feels like it's about something post-war as well, post-Second World War. Because the Second World War was really the last time when a large industrialized democratic nation could invade another large industrialized democratic nation and win very quickly.
Right.
And when you watch the way wars have played out since the Second World War, in large part, I guess it has something to do with the nuclear deterrent, because that is always the place of last resort. But also the sheer frightening technology that exists and the geopolitical world that we've lived in after the Second World War, with a toothless United Nations, yes, but at least it does exist. So yeah. Ways of funneling support into Ukraine are there. Mm. I guess what baffles me is, what makes Putin think that he could actually invade? What he expected to do was a blitzkrieg. You mentioned 39, he expected it to happen like a blitzkrieg, didn't he?
And he had a distorted view. I mean, Putin...
But it didn't, it didn't work,
had a distorted, no, it didn't work. And Putin had a distorted view of what they could achieve. And I think he's not somebody... He's circle narrowed, so there probably weren't people... He's circle narrowed during COVID, so there probably weren't as many people telling him what their chances were of defeating Ukraine. So he probably wasn't getting counter-information, and if he was... He wasn't listening to it, but probably also people are fearful of telling him the truth. As you know from history, Dan, it's always important to listen to the generals. Honest generals in democracies tell governments, don't do this. The question would be, were they telling Putin that? Maybe not. Maybe not, because their survival depends on telling him what he wants to hear. But I was there in the weeks leading up to the full-scale invasion, and I was in the woods north of Kyiv seeing... their citizens' defence training, people aged between 18 and 65.
The bouncer story.
Yeah, and I just knew that these people are going to resist at all costs. They are not going to give up, and that's what's happened. So, yeah, it's an awful period of time, and you're already seeing like what was happening with Venezuela and Guyana, that suddenly countries think, well, why don't we cross this border, and why don't we, you know, like, it's a quite a scary time, and if borders need to be respected, sovereignty needs to be respected, and it's disturbing given how much peace we've had in Europe for so long now that suddenly we've got a major full-scale war, and it is like trench warfare. I mean, we're back to the past, aren't we?
Disturbing but really important insight. To go back to the book, first tests, great Australian cricketers and the backyards that made them, ABC Books. Not sure whether it's on shelves anymore, but
I'm
not
sure.
You can definitely get it on in the digital ways.
Yeah, you should get it.
You
should be able
to
get it.
People who love the game and love the backstories of the players that we often talk about on Storytime. Daniel?
If you can't get it, you want a hard copy, start bidding now. I've got one. It's absolutely brilliant, but it's not going for less than $2,000.
Steve, thinker, friend, supporter, massive contribution over here doing what you do as a senior journalist. We're going to miss you an awful lot, but it's been great spending some time with you this afternoon, and we've got your going away party to get to. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, and as I said, I love the podcast and I love hanging out with you guys, and it's been fantastic to chat about something I haven't really thought about for a while, but I really loved writing that book, and I loved talking to those cricketers, guys like Neil Harvey, Richie Beno, Alan Davidson, the Chapels. It was an absolute joy to talk to them about this, and also something that they were passionate talking about. So to be able to, you know, revisit some of that, it's been very enjoyable. So thank you.
And the great thing is, we know exactly where to find you at the SCG at the Sydney Test next
behind
year.
The bowler's arm. I'll be there.
Yeah, just where I found you 15 years ago. Cheers, Steve.
Thanks, guys. I had to go.